The History of Literature podcast is a member of the Podglomerate Network and Lit Hub Radio. Kicking things off with some fanfare today because this is episode 600, and man, the more we clock these big numbers, tick them off, march past them, the prouder I am that we're still rattling along with this humble little podcast. You might think it's the opposite. You might think I'm thinking, well, wow. Or you might be thinking, wow, 600 episodes? Haven't you come to your senses yet? Far from it, haters. Far from it. And why would we stop now when we have so many excellent guests who love literature and literary culture and great books and great writers? They make the job easy and a lot of fun and enlightening. Today's guest is no exception. Phil Jones has written a book, and his people politely reached out to see if I might be interested in talking to Phil about it. And by the way, they said the book is called Reading Samuel Johnson. Would I? Yes, please. That good doctor, a hero of mine, as longtime listeners will know. I'm not sure why exactly I have such a fondness for Dr. Johnson. We don't have that much in common, but he's one of my heroes nevertheless. And we do have in common an absolute love of literature, so maybe that's enough. So we will have Phil Jones here today to go into the good doctor, and then, well, I was saving this one, but I'm going to add this to the mix in honor of episode 600. It's a very special, my last book, one of the best. All that today on the History of Literature. Okay, here we go, people. Thank you for joining me. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Jack Wilson, etc. You might be wondering how various episodes have fared over the years, and you might be wondering why the theme song is going on. Let me see if I can fix that on the fly here. Turn it down. Okay. You might be wondering how various episodes have fared over the years. It's been a while since we gave you a top 10 list. Been a while since I checked it, actually. The top 10 episodes of all time. So why don't we do that now? Proust and George Eliot are usually right up there, and the brothers Karamazov used to be before I took that episode down because it is so heartbreakingly sad. I might make that available again at some point, but maybe not. That was almost too much for me. Okay, wow. Wow, looking at the chart here, I see the numbers have changed quite a bit. I throw out episode 0 and episode 1 because that feels a little bit like cheating. People are just trying to start at the beginning. Gilgamesh and what was episode 0 called? Something about the ditch, right? Me lying in the ditch. Something about, I can't remember. But anyway, I like the ones that are about actual topics that people aren't choosing because of the number, but because they found the subject. And I see that number 10 on the list is now an episode that Mike and I did on Philip Roth, which is barely ahead of an episode with Tom Rosten on Kurt Vonnegut. Barely. Maybe next time, Kurt Vonnegut. Next time, let's see. Next up, number 9 is an episode on Sylvia Plath and Ted Hughes with Heather Clark. That is a worthy episode. Check that one out in our archives. Heather Clark has written an incredible biography of Sylvia Plath. She is truly an expert. Number 8 is Rilke and the Search for God. Number 7 is a Mike Palindrome guest episode, Infinite Jest by David Foster Wallace. Number 6 is The Great Gatsby. Number 5, George Orwell. Number 4 is our episode on Anna Karenina. Number 3 is a special episode with Blume, Kafka's Metamorphosis, and shout out to Blume. She's going through some hard times. Hang in there, Blume. Our hearts are with you and your loved ones, and our fingers are crossed. Number 2 is an episode on T.S. Eliot and The Wasteland. And the number 1 episode of all time, replacing Proust and George Eliot, previous winners of the category, is currently episode number 339, Jack Kerouac. Congratulations to all of the contenders, including the current last place finisher. Let's see. Can I get there? I know. Maybe I shouldn't. That's a little bit cruel. And frankly, it's taking me a while to click through to get to the last place finisher. I'm only getting 9 or 10 of these episodes at a time. I'm curious, though, to see. But hang on. Hang on. I can download. And guess what? When I look at the full report, stop the presses, something weird has happened. There is a scandal brewing here. Downloaded the full report so I could look, and guess what? The top 10 was all messed up. What I just gave you was not accurate. On the screen, it's not the same as the full report downloaded, but this looks more accurate. So here is the actual top 10. We'll do this quickly. Number 10, George Orwell. Number 9, Anna Karenina. Number 8, Marcel Proust. Yes. Yes, that was weird that it wasn't in the top 10. Number 7, Kafka's Metamorphosis with Blume. And shout out to Blume. My heart is aching. Hugs and well wishes from America, Blume. Number 6, Ernest Hemingway. Number 5, T.S. Eliot in the Wasteland. Number 4, Jack Kerouac. Number 3, Dostoevsky. Number 2, Sylvia Plath. And the number 1 episode, as of today, is Haruki Murakami. Once again, my thanks to all the contenders, and good luck to all you losers, all you loser episodes. Maybe you'll find your audience before episode 700. And now, let's hear from Phil Jones, and we'll get into some Dr. Johnson discussion. We're traveling back to the 18th century for this, and then we'll have a special My Last Book, maybe the most moving one ever. I've gotten a lot of great responses from guests, but this one was truly, it brought tears to my eyes. It's with Rupert Holmes, the songwriter and author. All that after this. Hello, everyone. This is Jack here to tell you about a way to eat better and easier. That's right, Factor, and their delicious, ready-to-eat meals. These things are amazing, chef-crafted, always fresh, never frozen. All you do is heat them up and you're ready to go. No prepping, cooking, or cleanup, and you get something healthy, nutritious, and tasty. I love Factor meals, especially on those days when I'm in the office. They're better for me than snacks or junk food, and much cheaper and faster than buying my lunch at a restaurant. You can choose options like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, Keto, and you can change your schedule to get as much or as little as you need every week, whatever suits you and your family best. Head to factormeals.com/literature50 and use code literature50 to get 50% off. That's code literature50 at factormeals.com/literature50 to get 50% off. Hey, grown-ups, the Cat in the Hat cast is a new podcast from Wondery, perfect for the whole family. Join the Cat in the Hat and your favorite Dr. Seuss characters as they get whisked away on a new adventure every week. Fish dreams of creating his very own polite and quiet podcast. That is, until he gets a surprise visit to his Fishbowl podcast studio from the Cat in the Hat himself, and it becomes very clear that the cat has other plans for the podcast, and those plans are the opposite of quiet. The cat may be disruptive, but it turns out he's also a great help to get Fish out of all kinds of predicaments. Bursting with music, silliness, and rhymes, the Cat in the Hat cast encourages us all to find fun that is funny in every episode. Sing along to new favorite songs, try your luck at Titanic tongue twisters, have some fun with wondrous wordplay, and most importantly, bring your family along for all of the adventures in the Cat in the Hat cast. Follow the Cat in the Hat cast on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to the Cat in the Hat cast ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Okay, joining me now is Philip Jones, who's an independent scholar and chairman of the Johnson Society in Litchfield. He has written widely on Johnson and the 18th century in Johnson Society journals. He joins us today to discuss his book, Reading Samuel Johnson, Reception and Representation, 1750 to 1970. Philip Jones, welcome to the History of Literature.
Thank you very much, Jack, and I'm very glad to be with you on this program.
So I think a lot of us come to Dr. Johnson, as I did, as a figure in a biography, and Boswell's Life of Johnson is such an incredible book, and the character of Johnson in that book is so unforgettable and just indelible that I think a lot of people stop there and probably don't go on to read Johnson. And I'm wondering, your book focuses on Johnson's writing and its reception and influence over the years. I'm wondering, what do we miss if we just read Boswell's Life of Johnson and stop there?
Well, it's a great question, Jack. And Boswell's Life of Johnson is a fantastic biography. As people will know who've read it, it's almost like the 18th century version of reality TV, because Boswell literally sat there at the table and wrote down everything Johnson said afterwards. So you get a sense of being there live, and there's no biography prior to that that I'm aware of, which gave that real sense of the live presence of Johnson, of his humanity, his wit, his large-scale personality. I think what you do miss, though, if you don't go beyond there, is the fact that Johnson is a jack-of-all-trades. He, like many 18th-century writers, he wrote in an incredibly different number of different forms.
Yeah.
So, for instance, early in his career, he's arguably the first, in Britain anyway, the first parliamentary reporter. In Britain, US listeners may or may know that we get the first parliaments formed at the start of the 18th century. But they were not subject to reporting. There were controls. You couldn't report what was happening there. And Johnson devised a means of actually portraying what was happening in Parliament as a fiction, almost like a Gulliver's Travel type fiction. And he actually, these came out 6 months later. So he actually was a live reporter on what was happening in politics. He wrote the famous dictionary, which people will may be familiar with. I mean, it plays a great part in American history because Jefferson and others had Johnson's dictionary. And when he framed the Declaration of Independence, he may well have made use of that dictionary in seeking to be clear about the meaning of words.
Right.
Besides that, he wrote poetry. He wrote marvelous essays, which really are at the core of what Johnson did. And he wrote a small novelette called Rasselas, which is worth reading as well. So all those things are aspects of the things he wrote about. He was a writer for hire. He wrote sermons. He wrote introductions. You name it, he wrote it.
I'm glad you started with something early in his career, because that is one of the things about Boswell's Life of Johnson. In addition to getting just Boswell's filter of the things that would be seemingly most important to him, he also came along kind of late in Johnson's life, and he was a generation behind. It's not like a biography, if people haven't read it, it's not a biography that, you know, where someone is taking a look at the whole career and you feel like they're treating each, you know, decade with an equal, giving it an equal treatment. It really does kind of land more heavily on Johnson later in life. And that's the period where Boswell knew him was, Johnson was already kind of older. And so, for example, writing about Parliament is not something I remember reading about in Life of Johnson.
No, I mean, it doesn't cover that much. And in fact, you're absolutely right, because Johnson was already in late middle age when he met the young Boswell, who was in his early 20s then. A young lawyer on the make in London. And his information upon Johnson's early life in particular, and what's happened up to the point that he met him, he had to really beg people for information, beg for letters. So there's a fair number of letters in the life. And he also, you know, one of the people who write around later, people like Fanny Burney, they also wrote their own accounts from Mrs. Swale of having known Johnson, but they knew him in a different environment. They knew him in an environment in salons where he's in more domestic company and where he wasn't always on the stage declaiming and being witty. Right. They captured him in a more intimate domestic mood. And he was very good with ladies in that sense.
Yeah.
And so they reflect a different person. Boswell knew that, and he begged Burney for more of the information from her about her accounts, and she wouldn't let him have it. So there is a partiality in what Boswell writes. He doesn't manage to nail it all. But he's also very keen, right at the start of the biography, to diss all the other biographers who were setting forth. This is the biblical text. You can ignore all these other interlopers like Hawkins and Mrs. Swale and others.
Right. So one of the things about Johnson that I think is probably worth noting is that he is also maybe the greatest literary critic of all time. And he's such a judicious and canny reader that it's no surprise that he also could turn his literary critical eye on his own writing. And in fact, your book begins with a look at Johnson as a self-reader. So what do you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting that, because you're right, he was a wonderful literary critic, and that was also recognized by later writers like Matthew Arnold, T.S. Eliot into the 20th century, and others, and Lord Byron. He was a very penetrating critic who wrote from his experience, not according to a formula. But what I'm referring to as a self-reader was actually Boswell's life of Johnson portrays an individual who is extrovert, rambunctious, always putting people down, always full of wit, a man very certain of his views. When you actually start to look at the diaries in particular and some of the Rambler essays, you see a different Johnson, and this is the Johnson which writers like Samuel Beckett were attracted to. He was a very inward, introverted man in some respects. Mm-hmm. And that dogmatism which Boswell portrays is not a feature necessarily of his writing. You come across an individual who is much more uncertain of himself. And in the diaries in particular, he's trying to account for what he's achieved in life and what he's done. And in particular, which is the link to the Puritan tradition of diary writing, he's very engaged with the idea of, will he be saved?
Mm.
Will he go to heaven? Has he done enough? Has he got enough moral worth in the bank to be able to pass that final hurdle, if you like?
Yeah.
And you get a Johnson who's very, very much more uncertain, subject to depression often. And he actually, what comes through very strongly in the diaries is he uses numbers and lists and accounts to try and create some order in his life. So he does all sorts of things like amateur scientists would have done in the 18th century. He actually shaves the hair off his arm and works out how long it takes to grow back. He'll sit in a church sermon and actually time how long it takes. There's almost a kind of, it's what modern psychologists call arithmomania. There's almost an obsessional idea to count. And he's trying to count his life, trying to see what he's achieved and what it all adds up to.
Yeah.
So it's a very different view of Johnson in that sense. He's very self-critical, full of doubt, engaging very different views. So it's a different individual from the one that you see in Boswell's life.
Yeah. I wonder if that's because of his devotion and to literature and his immersion in literature. I mean, one of the things that comes to mind is, you know, any student who takes an English course or, you know, sort of probably feels like, well, this is so subjective and it's all about my ideas and it's being measured by that. But I kind of like the math courses where there's a correct answer and you can tally something up and get to something with some certainty. And I wonder if he felt that in a world where he was so devoted to ideas and judgments of things like art that are difficult to quantify, if that was one of the things that pushed him toward, you know, the measuring of distances and the counting that he did.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, Jack. And I think the term you use, certainty, is one that he used himself.
Mm.
So clearly in art, you can't add up whether a poem or a novel gets 9 out of 10 or 8 out of 10. But in mathematics, you can come to a perfect solution. And Johnson actually said that mathematics brings everything to a certainty. And he liked that because it was one way of apprehending the world. You could see whether, I mean, one of the things he did, for instance, was his own father was a rather unsuccessful businessman. And he never actually did his accounts properly. So he didn't know actually whether he'd made a profit or loss. Johnson, after his father died, actually retrospectively put his accounts into order and worked out what the worth of the business was. In that way, he kind of replaced the father and actually, in effect, installed some order and some mathematical certainty around what he'd been achieving. But your point's fundamentally right. He had that need to try and quantify things. So when he went round Worcester Cathedral, he paced it from end to end. And in a sense, what that was part of his desire to try and put some maths round distances, but also behind it, he wanted to see whether it was longer or shorter than Lichfield Cathedral, where he lived.
Yeah.
And he concluded wrongly that it was actually shorter. There's a sort of bias going in there because he wanted it to be not as grand as his home cathedral. So some of his counting went a bit awry. And one of the things he did, which is quite fascinating, is he did keep account books in his diaries, but he kind of fixed them. So he gave money away. He was a very generous man. So he gave money away to members of his establishment at Gough Square. He'd give it away to people in the street. And these accounts never added up because the bit missing was the money he gave away. So it's he was a kind of almost like a parody accountant. He sought to actually make things add up. But the way he lived, which is fundamentally a decent way of living, meant that he couldn't achieve it.
Yeah. All of these contradictions, I mean, I love the contradictions in Johnson because he comes across in the biography as someone who's got so much certainty and is so correct most of the time and always gets the best last word and always has the perfect way of encapsulating something. And he's just so admirable and he's so heroic. And it does, but he's so appealing when he's racked with doubt or when he has some kind of failure or when he does something unexpected, like his friendship with the poet Richard Savage and these moments where you see him, where it's almost like his guard is down a little bit, or you see the humanity shining through. It makes him such it's sort of like we love hearing about celebrities, but we don't just want to hear about all their successes. We also like knowing that they have some really unusual weaknesses as well.
You're absolutely right, because a perfect individual would be insufferable to most people, wouldn't they? Because there would be no dramatic light and shade within their personality. As long as you didn't take on Johnson head on, he would admit to weaknesses. I think the great risk was if you took Johnson on head on, and because he was accommodative by nature, he would naturally respond in kind. Would he even adopt the opposite stance to his own real opinion, just for the sake of an argument? You know, he thought there was no proper conversation which didn't finish by somebody winning and somebody losing. But if you caught him off his guard where he wasn't actually in effect in conversational combat, he would actually be quite open-minded. I mean, many of the Ramblers contradict each other even in successive weeks. And I'm going to forget the exact definition, but he was asked, somebody pointed out that his definition of a pastern, which was a part of a horse's leg, was wrong. And why was that? And he said something like, well, complete ignorance, ma'am. And he was quite happy to toss that off. And then he did The Marvelous Lives of the Poets, which is, you know, the first probably great literary critical biographical review, you know, canon of English literature. You know, the biographical bits, he just borrowed off people. He wasn't really terribly interested in that. And he wasn't terribly troubled whether the facts were right or wrong. So there was a kind of carelessness about things that he didn't regard as terribly important.
Mm.
But he was willing to look at himself and admit his failures. And I think he regretted often the way he'd treated his wife and missed her greatly when she'd gone, Tetty.
Yeah, right. And he also, I know he had some doubts. I remember being so struck by his feeling that Pope and Dryden had kind of perfected poetry in a way, and that he could only approximate it, or it would only be second best or something. He didn't seem to have the view of, well, I can write in my own style and advance this in some way or become superior. He sort of was willing to defer to, well, they figured out the best way to do it and they've done it. And
I will just be, you know, in their shadow.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, there is a view that, you know, the Harold Bloom notion of excitative influence, which certainly Johnson wouldn't have admitted to, operated on his poetical productions, and that Pope was such a summit of perfection that you just simply couldn't go beyond it.
Yeah.
Having said that, I mean, I think many later commentators, including modern commentators, would point to the Vanity of Human Wishes as possibly being one of the greatest, if not the greatest, poems of the second half, of the mid-second half of the 18th century. And if you look at the later readers, which I refer to in my book, from Byron through to Scott, through to Arnold, through to Eliot, they're all overwhelmingly positive about his poetical abilities. Eliot said, well, if Johnson isn't a great poet, who is? I mean, this is T.S. Eliot, the great poet of the modern 20th century, who's pointing particularly to Our Human Wishes as a very, very, very fine poem. Interestingly, Matthew Arnold, the 19th century Victorian poet and writer, followed a similar path in that he also largely gave up poetry in later life and moved to literary criticism. And I kind of argue that in one respect he was following Johnson's model, because that's what you get to a degree with Johnson. Although he wrote poetry throughout his life, he didn't pull out the poetic big guns in the same way that he'd done it earlier in his career. He more drifted towards literary criticism, of course, the last great work being The Lives of the English Poets. So there might be an element in which, you know, the point you make is, if you like, belief in Pope and Dryden's supremacy in that arena pushed him more towards prose. And after all, probably most people would argue his fine literary productions were the Ramblers, which were written in his very, very distinctive prose style.
Yeah. I seem to remember Boswell, when Johnson would express those doubts about his worth, that Boswell seemed to have pointed to those essays in particular as saying, how can you say that the man who wrote these essays that Boswell and so many others had admired, in addition to the dictionary and all of the other achievements, how can you possibly believe that about yourself?
Yeah, you're right. As we said earlier, though, he was a man of contradictions. I mean, Walt Whitman's line, "I contradict myself, well, yeah. I contradict myself," could equally apply to Johnson. And he would say very different things in different moods. And of course, whilst he is very tentative about what his own view is of or what he's achieved in literature, he says that at the end of The Ramblers, he hopes he'd been able to dignify truth. Mm. He does also say that the Ramblers are his wine. Mm. The productions are, you know, all the productions are watered. So I think he knew they were good.
Yeah.
And they are good because in as much as the style that he developed in there, which is one of the great styles in English prose, you know, and lots of other writers in the 18th century copied him or imitated or indeed parodied him. And, you know, if you look at the great essayists down the ages, from Johnson, Dryden through to Hazlitt and through to Pater and Eliot and Arnold, he is one of the very distinctive stylists. You know, the elements of his style are the balancing clauses, the antitheses, the musical role of the prose. It's a wonderful style for a man who came from the provinces and only had a year at university. You know, he forged that style almost as though it's a badge of identity.
Yeah. Okay, let's take a quick break and then return with Philip Jones, and we'll hear how Johnson's writings have been taken up by readers and critics throughout the centuries. Okay, we're back. So let's go through some of the chapters in your book and see how the responses to Johnson's writings changed over time. And I'd like to begin with Mrs. Thrale and Fanny Burney and Jane Austen, who were kind of right in that generation, coinciding with Johnson and maybe coming just after him. Would you say that their responses to Johnson kind of represent the concerns of their era?
They do, and also they introduce a woman's perspective, which is that's the key difference. So you know, you've got, of the three, two are novelists, and you get the emergence of the novel at the back end of the 18th century.
Yeah.
So you get a very different perspective to the one that you would have got from Boswell, which is a very masculine view of him. Mm-hmm. Boswell's Johnson is a hero who declaims, who dominates situations. He's quite a macho individual.
Yeah.
What Mrs. Thoreau Birney, in particular, who knew him, Jane Austen didn't know him because she lived, you know, never met him, lived after him, really, saw him up close. They saw him in domestic settings, particularly Mrs. Thrale, who entertained Johnson at Streatham, where she lived in comfortable surroundings with her husband, who was a wealthy brewer. And Fanny Burney, in fact, visited the Streatham household, and that's where she got to know Johnson. So the Johnson they knew was rather different. And what you get from Mrs. Thrale in particular is quite interesting. She wrote what's called an Anna style, A-N-A, which was borrowed from the French, where it's, rather than it being a structured biography like Boswell's, is more like anecdotes, short anecdotes, which aren't framed in the same way. They can seem almost random in an order and content. And because she wrote about Johnson in that way, you get a Johnson which doesn't quite add up in the same way. Mm. She doesn't have a coherent narrative of the hero who dominates all situations. She shows him doing silly things, laughing, shows him writing parodies. She also shows him behaving in a childish manner. And you get a bit of the same from Fanny Burney, but Fanny Burney brings the novelist's skill to bear in depicting him. And she looks to Johnson as a literary father, because for emerging female novelists, in particular in the 18th century, there weren't any real backers for them, and it's quite a novel thing for them to do, to write. And Johnson was her backer for her. He noticed early on what talent she had. He actually said that Burney had more talent at her age than Alexander Pope did, which in his book was praise indeed. And that gave her great self-belief. And he became, in effect, as a literary father, she looked to him as a novelist primarily, because that then validated her own career as a novelist. So Rasselas becomes quite important. By the time we moved to Jane Austen, we've got somebody who has never met Johnson, but grew up reading him. And she, in effect, absorbs his kind of, some of his thinking into her, the ways that she writes. But she has a very independent style. Many modern 20th century critics said that she almost sounds like a regurgitated version of Johnson. I don't agree with that at all. I think Jane Austen wrote in a more subtle style. And the double voice of irony, which dominates Jane Austen's works, very different from the way that Johnson himself wrote. But she did take from him a number of, if you like, moral imperatives, and they both were engaged with the idea of what distinguishes authentic from performative or dissimulatory behavior. They were both very engaged with that. And they were both very engaged with what is proper in terms of moral conduct, and how do you present yourself in society, and how do you present an honest face. So it operated at a more subtle level with Jane Austen. But all three of them really used his, if you like, his prose voice and developed it for their own purposes. They didn't merely mimic what he did. They actually put their own female voice over the top of it and learnt and moved on from him. So rather than the great male battles that Harold Bloom in particular would point out between male writers, it felt more like a nurturing relationship.
Mm. Johnson's writing, I mean, I don't know if we've talked enough yet about just what it's like to read Johnson, but it always struck me as like you said, the balance and the sort of rhythm of the prose is so strong and it's so sonorous, but yet he gets a lot of energy and gusto into it and also a lot of playfulness and humor. It's really a kind of a style that you see throughout the 19th century in those great novelists and those great, you know, the strong narrative voices of people who are kind of setting a scene for you and giving you a kind of intelligent look at a society and making sweeping claims, but also being willing to kind of focus on some minutia and maybe being a little bit humorous about it.
You're right. I mean, he was a witty writer. And in his later career, particularly in the Lives of the Poets, he wrote rather more simply. So he could write simple sentences. But the classic Johnson that most people would know is the guy who could knock out sentences which were 150 words. And they were developed very carefully, usually with about three or four subjects. So it was a structured way that he wrote. And the analogy I've used in the past is a little bit like a train journey. So you stop at a number of stations en route, and it's only by the final terminus you know where the journey's been, because he's carefully pulled it all together through that sentence. That will all read very differently from somebody who's used to 20th century prose. So if you think of American prose in the 20th century, it starts with Twain. You look at Hemingway's sentences, some of them which only have five words in them and are full of conjunctions and hardly any adjectives. It's a prose which is very different from the prose that Johnson wrote. And it does take a bit of reacclimatization to get used to that voice that you hear in Johnson. But he largely doesn't waste a word. He makes each word count. But obviously, it's a different type of prose and full of Latinate words, big long words. And that's what some of his contemporaries took the mick out of him about. They say he was just using these big, long, hard words to make an impression rather than convey a real sense, which is unfair. But that was a criticism which was made of him.
Right. Now, when you move to the Romantic era, are you looking at authors like Hazlitt and other literary critics and essayists, or are you looking at the poets and looking at the influence that Johnson might have had on them?
I do a bit of scene setting and look at very briefly at Wordsworth and Coleridge, who didn't say an awful lot about Johnson, but were negative.
Uh-huh.
And they largely echo the views of William Hazlitt, the essayist, a marvellously lively essayist. And their view of Johnson is he's rigid, he's machine-like, and he doesn't reflect the values that the Romantics themselves now were starting to espouse 30 years on after Johnson's death, of spontaneity and imagination, the concern with nature, the concern with originality. So Johnson, for them, is almost the totem of the rationalism that they perceive as being the hallmark of the 18th century. Of course, they were unfair in that respect, because the 18th century was an era when lots of things were changing and moving. And Johnson, if you look to his own self-writing in the diaries and the Ramblers, is full of uncertainty, not dogmatism. So in effect, they overwrite him, really, to support their own literary agenda, which is trying to move in a different direction. So Hazlitt, in my view, I've looked at the way that he also wrote about contemporary utilitarian philosophers such as Jeremy Bentham, who emphasize reason and rationalist ways of thinking about things to a very extreme degree. And in my own mind, he assimilates Johnson to those kinds of writers because he uses very similar similes, tropes, and adjectives to describe them. So he characterizes Johnson as a machine who can't really write at all. He simply writes almost like a computer with these balancing clauses. What he does point to, however, which is interesting, he does see the skepticism in Johnson's writing in a way that I don't think that, for instance, Boswell did. And what he argues is that Johnson doesn't take his skepticism far enough, because if he tries to push the boundaries in terms of what he's saying, his own religious convictions always draw a boundary around that. Mm-hmm. So he doesn't go much further than that. So that's the kind of Hazlitt end of things. By complete contrast, the poet Lord Byron looks to Johnson as a very positive exemplar and in supporting him, because Byron's got a foot in both the 18th century and the 19th century and writes satire, which, of course, you know, that would be an anathema to most of the Romantic poets like Wordsworth and the others. He looks to Johnson as a literary father, and he looks to him as somebody who he can enlist in his fight against his fellow Romantic poets. So he says something like, oh, were Johnson alive today to wipe out all the Lakers, and by that he means Wordsworth and others, and all the contemporaries like Keats. He's looking to Johnson as somebody who has absorbed the classical values that he also had done. And in fact, in one of his poems called Mazeppo, it's quite clearly that he echoes bits of Vanity of Human Wishes. And the common thread between the two is this notion of it's what Hemingway talked about, the sun also rises, this idea that everything which has been said and done has already happened. And he actually, made a joke of it almost, that he did borrow from other writers. And there isn't a real notion of originality. And it's the classical view. The romantic view is you create everything anew. The classical view is that basically we're using formal models. And what we've said has probably been said as well as, if not better, by somebody in the past. And to a degree, Johnson and Byron would have agreed on that. And also this sense of that you get from the Bible in particular of, the vanity of humor, which is experience always ends up not necessarily with good outcomes. The idea that experience itself is empty and doesn't fulfill. That's a thread which is common to both Johnson and Byron, as it was common later with Beckett. That sense that you will never get true fulfillment in that sense.
Mm. Let's move on to the Victorians. What were they looking to Johnson for?
Well, you get Johnson's reputation picks up again under the Victorians, as often happens in literary history, as I'm sure you're aware, Jack, is that literary generations react against their previous generation. That happens throughout history. And Johnson's reputation recovers under the Victorians, particularly under writers such as Carlyle, Matthew Arnold, and also George Birkbeck Hill. He was widely admired by Charles Dickens, who came to see his house here in Lichfield. He's admired by Thackeray and others. And you can see in a way why it was, because in the mid-late Victorian era, there was a lot of forces for change. You've got the coming of evolutionary theory, which seemed to make the whole landscape seem as though it was shifting. You've got the trains which are coursing up and down the country. You got Pater writing about the fastness of life and how things seem just like perceptions now. In amongst all this enormous change, Johnson looked like a very secure figure. Mm. He's the famous individual who kicks the stone to disprove Berkeley's theory that the external world doesn't exist. He's a man who exists amongst these solid objects, and he looks quite reliable. And he's the guy who basically develops English prose as the English democracy is starting to emerge in the 18th century. And as you get liberal figures like Arnold and others who are in the midst of a developing and burgeoning democracy in Britain throughout the 19th century, which rises with various parliamentary reform acts and various educational reform acts, he's very sympathetic to them because he's wielding a prose which they see as a useful implement and tool in the development of English culture and English democracy. So you get a move away from an obsession with classical literature, which dominated the universities and dominated the public schools, to where we actually celebrate English heroes, if you like. And Johnson's seen as one of them. He's somebody who's starting to develop the English language, the dictionary, and as you get the rise of empire, you see an investment in the English language as something which has its own energy and life and the culture of the Englishness, which can compete with classical culture. So he's seen as quite heroic in that sense.
Right. And he would say, we have Shakespeare and we have Milton, and look what's great about these almost, you could call them institutions.
Absolutely. And you also get this sense of in Carlyle, who's a very peculiar writer, but he celebrates some of these key episodes in Johnson's life. And one of them was when he went to the Uttoxeter Market, which is a little village close to Lichfield, where his father, 40 years previously, had asked him to help him with the bookstore. And he refused, and Johnson felt guilty about that. So Johnson rode all the way to Uttoxeter, bared his head, and stood in the rain in penance. And that becomes a very emblematic figure of the man Johnson, the human man Johnson, who could, I think as we were talking earlier, could recognize his own weaknesses and failures. It's almost the kind of Christ-like moment where he's standing in the square. And it's celebrated in statuary, which starts to emerge in the 19th century, both in Lichfield and elsewhere. You know, this is the figure who was, heroic, but also could admit his own fallacies.
Yeah. And he also loves life. I mean, that's the other thing, is he loves London and he loves the theater and he loves, you get the sense that he loves his work and he loves having these dinner parties and just kind of all of it. He brings to a sort of enthusiasm to it. And he's very good at saying what he likes and doesn't like, or what's good and what's not good, and making judgments. But he's, in general, he's on board for the whole project of living.
You're right, because I think the Ramblers, the essays, are fundamentally about what it's like to be alive.
Hmm.
And whilst you do get the downbeat moments, he lived life with gusto.
Yeah.
And one of his responses to actually his what was called the black dog, with his miseries,
right,
the term which Churchill later took up, was actually, you have to be active and you have to be amongst people. That's a way of diverting that. And when he was amongst people and could be on top form, he was, quite exhilarating. I mean, clearly you see that from all accounts, from all sorts of writers, that he could dominate conversations, and he seemed to know everything. His knowledge spread across such wide fields, from science, philosophy, literature, politics, history. And he could also talk in the way almost as though it were written. This is one of the things that Boswell notes. He talked so well that they were like completely fashioned sentences. So when people spoke to him, their first view of him is he was a very odd-looking individual whose own kind of personal characteristics were a bit hard. He had odd tics. He would talk to himself under his breath. And some people, like Hogarth, the artist, when he first met him, thought he was an idiot until he started to speak brilliantly. And that was not an uncommon experience on Katherine Johnson.
Yeah.
He would suddenly come to life and speak with this great passion and gusto. And he was a passionate individual, as you say, and greatly interested in all sorts of things. He was interested in the way that factories worked. He was interested in the way that the brewery worked, where he stayed with Mrs. Thrale. Her husband was the brewer, Henry Thrale. So he had a great gusto and energy to learn about life and to communicate it and to talk to others about it. So you're absolutely right. There was that attractive quality to him.
Yeah. Okay, so let's move into the 20th century, and I know you talk about T.S. Eliot and Sam Beckett and Borges. So what were they getting from Johnson?
Slightly different things. For Eliot, he looks to him as a classicist. So almost like Arnold, they're interested in effect, in a generational battle with the Romantic poets, in a sense, in that Eliot starts off with this notion that actually poetry isn't emotion recollected in tranquility as Wordsworth would have it. It's actually about creating an artifact, an objective plurality, is the term used, which will actually pull together and bring together very different threads to communicate an aesthetic experience. What he takes from Johnson is some support from that view, because he sees Johnson as a fellow classicist in that sense. But he also takes from very strongly the common interest in both in the Civil War. So Johnson himself saw the Civil War in England in the 1640s, 1660s as really, it's what the Americans would feel in the same way about the Civil War in the States, was it was a moment of society breaking up and breaking down, and it unleashed all sorts of forces like the challenge to the state, the challenge to the church, as dissenting churches established themselves, where the center was not the church hierarchy, but individuals actually looking to their own consciences. All of those things Johnson found unconscionable, and Eliot shared that view. So when you come to him writing about, in the late 30s, 40s, about his view of the dissociation of sensibility, the term that he used early in his career, he starts to associate it with the Civil War in England. He now argues that it was caused by that the dissociation of sensibility was because the old consensus was around settled communities, around the role of the church, have broken up. And that's what he also writes about in Little Gidding. Of course, Eliot's writing about these things as he was living in London with the Blitz happening.
Mm.
So there's an element in which the war linked the two. So you've got America, Eliot, who will remember through his own relatives the US Civil War, and Johnson, who remembers the Civil War in England. And there's a link between the two. And there's a link about speech. They both think that Milton is a writer who moves away from speech. And Eliot looks to Johnson to articulate that. He's wanting to return poetry to something more speech-like. So if you look at the first lines of Proof Outlets, as you go, then you and I, it's a very talkative, conversational prose. It's not the kind of words which the Romantic poet had used. And he looks to Johnson to support that view. So in Eliot, you get that sense of he's he's linking up to that critical consciousness that Johnson's got. Mm. Beckett's very different. Beckett's looking to the man in a way. He's looking to the man of the diaries in particular. Mm-hmm. And he's looking to Johnson's misery. And Beckett, being a writer, of course, was absorbed in the negative in life and the notion of the void.
Yeah.
Sees that in Johnson. He sees that very strongly. But Beckett starts to write a play in his late 20s about Johnson, but never gets there. It's a bit like Godot. Godot never arrives in the play. Johnson never arrives. Yeah. But he kind of still figures in his later life. When he wrote out in 4 booklets, which are still at Reading University, you can sit down and see what Beckett wrote. He basically writes out great chunks of stuff about Johnson and from Johnson's works. It's almost as though he's kind of hardwiring those texts, and they reappear in later guises. So we get individuals who, odd fashion, rather like Johnson, you get his references to accounts at all in Beckett's books of cod accounts, you know, cod accounting books appear. You get notions of ledger, and you get a sense that some of the themes which interested him and he was picking out in the books he was reading in Dublin University are actually reappearing in his prose. And his phrase was, Johnson's always the one that's with me. He was a great influence on Beckett in the way that, you know, might be quite surprised. And then finally we get Borges, who takes a completely different turn on him. And he's interested in the relationship between Boswell and Johnson.
Mm.
And he sees in the way as co-producers of the Boswell-Johnsonian oeuvre.
Yeah, right.
And he's interested in the way that he himself had a similar relationship with a young Argentinian writer called Casares, who was also writing in his journals about Borges, which echoed what Boswell was doing with Johnson. In fact, Borges said to Casares, "You are my Boswell." And that mirroring was of interest to him. And that relationship between the two, he in effect says, well, basically, Boswell invents Johnson, which is a 19th century trope, but he does it in a more postmodern way. But he also likes Johnson's prose. He likes Rasselas. He likes the musical sound of the prose, which Borges uses. So there's a lot of different approaches. So you got from Eliot, he's high modernist, through to Borges and Beckett, who are probably postmodernists, but all absorbed in this 18th century writer Johnson, who probably many writers have dismissed as a fusty relic from centuries before, but he's coming to life in these, you know, great writers.
Yeah. I could see Borges being really struck by the idea of reading of Johnson being so influenced by this biography of Johnson that most people know even better than the writings themselves. So for those of us, I think we've made the case now that Johnson is worth returning to as a writer. Do you have a recommendation for people who are looking for a place to begin? Or I'm a little bit worried because we've given so many different responses, it would almost depend on what type of person you are. But you must get this question sometimes of people who say, well, where should I start? I'd like to read a little Dr. Johnson to know what he's all about. Do you have a favorite that you point people toward?
I can give two answers in a way. I think for many people, including myself, the way in is often Boswell's Life of Johnson, and you can get abridged versions of it because that gives you a flavour of the man, and that often spurs people to reading. Going in another direction, simply because it's short, Rasselas, because it's less than 100 pages, it's a good read, and it's actually written rather differently than his kind of classic essayistic style. It's rather more economically written. And it is a good read, and it's short. He wrote it very quickly in a week to pay for his mother's funeral bills. And it's a good story. It's similar to Voltaire's Candide, similar theme of searching for happiness. And, of course, it concludes without any conclusion. It's Johnson's only real novelistic effort. And because it's short, I think it could grab people. It's a nice little piece.
Mm. Okay, well, the book is called Reading Samuel Johnson, Reception and Representation, 1750 to 1970. Philip Jones, thank you so much for joining me on the History of Literature.
Thank you very much. I much enjoyed it, Jack.
And finally today, Rupert Holmes.
You may know him from the Pina Colada song, also known as Escape. That is one of my favorite episodes among the 700, the conversation that I had with Rupert. He was here to discuss his very fun book, Murder Your Employer, The McMaster's Guide to Homicide. If you haven't checked out that book, it's fun. Imagine a Hogwarts dedicated not to magic, but to the art of murder. Students study how best to delete their most deserving victim. It's delightful stuff in an Edward Gorey kind of way. And Rupert was a delightful guest. Funny, urbane, extremely sharp, and full of tales from his years of experience as a pop star, as a songwriter for others like Dolly Parton and Barbara Streisand, a Broadway musical writer. Rupert won a Tony, if I recall correctly, for his musical based on Dickens's unfinished novel, The Mystery of Edwin Drood. Actually, I just looked it up. The play won 5 Tonys. Ah, wow. It was wonderful to talk to Rupert. And then when I asked him the special question, our conversation grew even deeper. We are joined now by Rupert Holmes, singer, songwriter, playwright, and novelist. Rupert, this question comes from a listener who asks, what do you want your last book to be? This will be the last book you will ever read. You can either choose one that exists or describe one that has not yet been written.
Well, the simple answer is I would read the last Sherlock Holmes story that I have never read. I have purposely never read the story about Thor Bridge. I realized I had come to the last Sherlock Holmes story written by Arthur Conan Doyle that I had never dealt with. And I thought, you know, if I read it, I have none. So I'm not going to read this one. And I'm going to wait till sometime where someone tells me some bad news about myself. And then the problem of Thor Bridge, here I come. Yeah. But the truth is, and this is sad, and I warn you in advance. I had a wonderful 10-year-old daughter, Wendy Isabel Holmes, and she died at the age of 10, out of the blue. We had no warning. And if you pose that question to me, I used to read to her every night, and I would probably read the last book I read to her once again, so that when I got to the end of that book, I could close it and I could say, as I always said to her, good night, I'll see you in the love morning. And so that's probably likely. The book would be The Land of Oz, which is not a great Oz book. It's a little weird at times, but we both enjoyed it. And so that probably is the last book I would like to read, because then I'll feel like I've sort of joined up with her.
Wow. That is a beautiful answer. And as a parent myself, I was just thinking earlier today about those moments that I treasure of the nights when I was sitting in the room with the boys and was reading aloud to them. It's kind of, I think it's probably my favorite of all the parenting moments, all the highs and all the lows, but there's really nothing that resonated with me more than those chances to read aloud to them.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. It was my joy. And we had a rule that if I came home from a gig at 2 in the morning, I had to wake her and read her. And I lived with that rule.
Yeah.
So, I didn't mean to get, I hope it didn't come off too maudlin, but it's the truth. It's what I would do.
Yeah. Well, I think it's just a wonderful answer. I'm struggling with a lump in my throat and tears in my eyes, but that's okay. That's part of literature and part of life.
Yep.
Rupert Holmes, thank you so much for joining me on the History of Literature.
My pleasure. Real honor.
Okay, there we go. My thanks to Phil Jones for helping me understand Dr. Johnson just a little bit better, and to Rupert Holmes for that lovely and heartfelt response. And to all of you, dear listeners, thank you so much for sticking with me all of these years and all of these hundreds of episodes. I'm truly grateful that you have helped to make all of this possible. And to my producer, Emma, and to the interns, and to our colleagues at the Podglomerate, and to the many sponsors we've had over the years, and to all of our Patreons over there at patreon.com/literature, and of course, all the people who have made a one-time donation at historyofliterature.com/donate. Thank you, thank you, And thank you. We'll be back next time with super guest Margot Livesey, who's been reading Thomas Hardy as she writes her latest novel. We'll talk about what she found, and she and I will trade some Thomas Hardy stories. Margot talks about the mistakes in Hardy's work, and I tell her of the incredible story of Thomas Hardy's wife and how their shocking relationship, with its dramatic conclusion, unlocked some of Hardy's greatest poetry. That will be the first episode in the new 100, the new 100, episodes 601 through 700. We're saying one at a time. That's how it works. And I hope you will join us for it. I'm Jack Wilson. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.